This morning in our study in Hebrews, I shared a little story with you about how a few years ago when Carol and I were traveling in Washington, D.C., I missed the turn that I was looking for, and the point of the story was, as I made this morning, that you cannot look for something ahead of you when it's already behind you. Tonight I want to give you, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story. We traveled past the street that I wanted to turn onto, didn't find it, got a few blocks down the street that we were on, and I said to myself, well, I'm sure I missed it. But I think if I would turn on any one of these streets that are ahead of me, they would probably run parallel to the street that I wanted and probably come out on the same road that I was hoping to find, and I would get back to the street that I wanted to get back to our motel. Wrong. The point of what I'm going to share with you is when you make a mistake, there are always consequences. Sometimes the consequences are minor, sometimes the consequences are great, but there's always consequences. We started traveling through neighborhoods, and we had to make sure the doors were locked. Every house we passed had iron bars over the windows. Kind of a good sign that you're not in a good neighborhood. Unless there's a bunch of iron dealers in the area, I'm not sure which. But nonetheless, we were traveling, and the road never did come out, or the street never did come out to the road that I was looking for, and I was recognizing that I was lost. And finally, after a while, we came on to a place where there were some commercial establishments, a little shopping plaza, and I did what is an anathema to practically every man. I stopped and asked for directions. I was a little scared, though, when I walked into this Family Dollar store and it had an armed security guard. I've never seen an armed security guard at a Family Dollar store. I mean, you know, Pennies or something, you know, maybe a little bit more upscale, but Family Dollar, no. I still was in a bad neighborhood. By the grace of God, I was able, though, to get directions and find out that we weren't actually too far from where I wanted to go, and obviously we arrived safe and sound. And that's what I want to encourage you with tonight. We will always, always, always make mistakes. No matter how careful we try to be in living our lives, we're bound to make mistakes. And every mistake has a consequence associated with it. It's good that we recognize that. Carol and I were in Kentucky Fried Chicken last night. Was the worst experience, I think, dining experience I have ever had. Literally waited between 5 and 10 minutes, and I was first in line. I waited between 5 and 10 minutes till someone came to the register. When they finally did, there was a line of maybe 6 or 7 customers behind me. But the family that came in behind us was a young man and his wife. They had a little girl and about, would you say, 2-3-year-old boy, something like that, somewhere in that vicinity. And they were getting tired of waiting, and the mom took this little boy over to sit down in one of the booths. Well, this little boy started screaming his head off, "I want that one!" And I mean, he was screaming his head off. I'm not exaggerating one iota. He was screaming, and one right after the other, "I want that one! I want that one!" It kept up for 10 minutes. And it was the most distracting thing. And the mother just held him. And I said to I leaned over and I said to Carol, "If that was mine, he wouldn't be crying about what he didn't get." But I thought to myself, there's a little boy that will not learn that there are consequences to the things that we do. And he will go through life probably expecting that if he puts up enough fuss, he can get whatever he wants without consequence. Fortunately, After about 10 minutes, the mother took him out to the car. And I was happy to see that their order was to go. It was the best part of the meal. Tonight we come to Joshua chapter 10. Israel had just made a mistake. In Joshua chapter 9, the Gibeonites presented themselves as coming from a far country in order to avoid the judgment of God. They made a pact with Joshua and the children of Israel, and now people that should have been recipients of the judgment of God and no longer participants in the land of Israel were now protected citizens. And we're going to see the consequences of the mistake that they made. Look at Joshua chapter 10, verse 1. Now it came to pass when Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, had heard how Joshua had taken Ai and had utterly destroyed it, as he had done to Jericho and her king, so he had done to Ai and her king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them, that they feared greatly, because Gibeon was a great city as one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all the men thereof were mighty. Wherefore Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, sent unto Hoham, king of Hebron, and unto Piram, king of Jarmuth, and unto Japhia, king of Lachish, and unto Debir, king of Eglon, saying, Come up unto me and help me, that we may smite Gibeon, for it hath made peace with Joshua and with the children of Israel. Now hear this, Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem. Interesting, 500 years before him, there was another man that had a similar name. His name was Melchizedek. He was a prince of righteousness. Adonai Zedek is the Lord of righteousness. Melchizedek came out to honor Abraham after he went off to battle and blessed him. Adonai Zedek said, we got to get rid of these people. 500 years, a great change had taken place in the people of Jerusalem in relationship to the children of Israel. Nonetheless, this man, I think, rightly recognized that the army of Israel was moving through this promised land, and individually, they really didn't have much of a chance. Their only possibility of surviving is if they came together in a confederacy. And on top of that, since the Gibeonites had made a league with Israel, now they were beginning to become outnumbered. So they get this confederacy, and their first objective is not to get rid of Israel, but to get rid of Gibeon. And they lay siege to it. They're making plans on how to take Gibeon. Verse 5, Therefore the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, the king of Eglon, gathered themselves together and went up, and all their hosts, and encamped before Gibeon, and made war against it. If they can get rid of the Gibeonites, now they really stand a chance against Israel. Well, here are these poor Gibeonites. They're outnumbered. What would they do? Verse 6, And the men of Gibeon sent unto Joshua to the camp of Gilgal, saying, Slack not thy hand from thy servants. Come up to us quickly and save us. Isn't that interesting? Here are the people that should have been destroyed by the Israelites calling out to the Israelites and saying, Save us. The people that Israel should have taken care of in judgment, now they're going to have to go back and protect. Now, if you were Joshua and the children of Israel, you could have sat there and said, we promised we wouldn't destroy them, but if we do nothing, we're not destroying them. And maybe God could use that as a possibility of rectifying our mistake. But the problem is they made a pact with them. And it pretty much necessitated that they provide some type of defense for them. All the kings of the Amorites that dwell in the mountains are gathered together against us. So Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor. recognizing that this is what they had to do, probably with a chip on their shoulder, saying, oh, boy, if we hadn't made that crazy pact with them, if we had only asked of the Lord, well, I guess I'll have to bite the bullet. And the Lord said unto Joshua, fear them not, for I have delivered them into thine hand. There shall not a man of them stand before thee. Joshua therefore came unto them suddenly, and went up from Gilgal all night. And the Lord discomfited them before Israel, and slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, chased them along the way that goeth up to Beth Horon, smote them at Azekah unto Makkedah. And it came to pass, as they fled from before Israel, and were going down to Beth Horon, that the Lord cast down great stones from heaven upon them unto Azekah, and they died. And they were more which died with hailstones than they whom the children of Israel slew with the sword. Then spake Joshua to the Lord in that day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, Sun, stand thou still upon Gibeon, and thou moon in the valley of Ajalon. And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed, until the people have avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is not this written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and hasted not to go down about a whole day. And there was no day like that before it or after it, that the Lord hearkened unto the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. Here's the children of Israel, having made a mistake, suffering the consequences, but by the grace of God, the consequences were lessened. In fact, even turned to victory. The most remarkable thing that goes on here is that at the very end, where the sun stands still. Most Bible commentaries that I read, at least, concentrate their teaching upon that subject. But I'd like to suggest to you that there are actually four supernatural events from the hand of God in correcting the mistake of Israel. First one is found in verse 7 and verse 9. It's a supernatural energizing of the people of Israel. I want you to notice a couple of things here. So Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor, verse 9, Joshua therefore came unto them suddenly and went up from Gilgal all night. Notice that they traveled at night. Notice in verse 7 that they ascended from Gilgal. Their journey was uphill. Their journey from Gilgal to Gibeon was about a 25-mile journey. Now think about that for just a moment. How long would it take you to walk 25 miles? Probably, if conditions were good, it would take you the best part of the night walking. But it wasn't just a person or two that was walking, it was the whole army of Israel. That's going to take a little bit longer. But it says that they came suddenly or quickly. So they weren't traveling 25 miles just walking leisurely. They were going at probably, a jog at least. Quick time. On the double, they were moving. They were moving at night. What's that tell me? Tells me that they had already been awake for all day. Nighttime's coming, they're probably already tired. Now they're going on a 25-mile jog, which is a marathon. Not only are they going on a 25-mile marathon quickly uphill, they're doing it when they have just nothing to do. It's uphill. After working all day, they had to be absolutely exhausted. And when they get there, there's no oh man, we're tired out. Where's there a Motel 6 around here? It's okay, we got here. Now we've got to fight the battle. The battle was already engaged with the Gibeonites and this confederacy of kings. It was literally out of the pan and into the fire. And yet, when they got out of the pan, somehow God energized them. somehow God gave them the strength to go out to battle. And may I say to you, there are times when you are just going to be exhausted. Whether it be because of poor planning, whether it be because of just something that you overlooked that you couldn't help, but some mistake that you made and it has consequences associated with it, and you've had a busy day, a trying day, and you say to yourself, where am I going to get the energy to deal with this? God has that ability. He is able somehow to provide supernatural energizing to the accomplishment of what's necessary. That's miracle number one. It's kind of overlooked, but I think it's there. Secondly, it says here, verse 10, and the Lord discomfited them. I call this a supernatural confusing. God somehow worked in the minds, the hearts, the wills, the attitudes, the feet, the arms, the legs. I don't know exactly what he did, but somehow here's this organized army. And I believe they had a lot of organization. I believe they came together, they set out a battle plan, and it wasn't just, okay, when we get there, let's fight. It was, here's how we're going to surround the city, here's who's going to go in first and what we're going to do second. I think they had a battle plan. And somehow that battle plan wasn't working. I like this, I said this before, I like the quip about when the first Iraqi war was taking place. The reason that we won that war is because we had General Schwarzkopf and they had General Dumkopf. I wouldn't doubt that there was probably a General Schwarzkopf-type person leading the confederations of armies. But they were losing. They were losing to a bunch of guys that were physically exhausted. Somehow, God was working in their lives that when they were swinging their swords, they were missing. And when Israel was swinging theirs, they were hitting. I had the most unusual experience just a little over a week ago. In fact, it was a week ago Saturday. Carol and I had been out, and we were coming back home, and we needed to stop at Nazer's to pick up a couple of things. We got in the store, it was Saturday afternoon, and it's when that one thunderstorm came rolling through here. We were in the middle of the store, and the power went out. We were fortunately near the back door, and I said to myself, we can just take all the groceries right out the back door, and no one will ever see us. We didn't do that. Stood there for a couple of minutes, and there was two other ladies that were in the vicinity with us. We started talking with them, and actually we started complaining a little bit. Why doesn't he have a generator? Why aren't the lights going on and so forth? And after a minute or two or three of just standing there with no electricity, my eyes adjusted to the dark, and I decided I was going to walk up the aisles to the registers. I could hear people up there, went up front, and here to my surprise, one of the girls on the register up there said he just bought a brand new generator. It's not working. Came back, talked with Carol a little bit more, and I decided, well, I'm going to go back up front again. I went up. Just as I went up, Bill Nazer was coming out of his office. He looked at me. He said, preacher, can you pray for light? And I said, let there be light. And there was no light. But I said to myself, you idiot. Here you've been complaining and talking about these things and you never thought to pray about it. And just quietly to myself, I just began to ask the Lord, Lord, here's a situation. Here's a man, I believe, who loves you. And his business is failing right now temporarily because it has no power. And just ask the Lord that the lights might come on, that the generator might work, or the electric company would put the electricity back on, however it may do that. Well, he started walking outside to where this generator was, and I followed along with him, and he was standing there with one of the other employees, and he had his flashlight out, and he was looking at a whole bank of circuit breakers and not finding anything, and I'm standing by this brand new generator, and I looked down, and there was a little like circuit breaker on the bottom of it, and I thought, that looks like that thing's turned off. I said to Bill, is that supposed to be like that? He reached down, flipped the switch, and the lights came on. Now, I want you to know, I know nothing about electric generators. I had no idea whether that thing worked or wouldn't work. But I asked God for something, and I believe God answered that prayer. I believe God can do the same thing in reverse to His enemies. I think God enabled me to see something that I didn't understand. I think God can put His hand over the eyes of the enemy that they're swinging blindly. And very possibly He may have done that right here. May I say to you, there are times when you make a mistake that you're going to have to pay for it. There's going to be consequences. But God might be able just to take His hand and put it over the eyes of those that will confront you, and they're going to miss badly. Thirdly, children of Israel were able to gain the advantage as they fought. But then it says this, and it came to pass, verse 11, as they fled before Israel, that these great stones came down from heaven. In verse 12, one of these verses, they're called hailstones. Nonetheless, yes, it is verse 11. They're called hailstones. I didn't catch this the first couple of times I read through this passage. When are they fighting this battle? They're fighting this battle during the day. Do you see any mention of rain? No mention of rain here. Hailstones happen when there are thunderclouds. The droplets of water come down, they get swept by the updraft, they go back up, they freeze, they come down, and they do this process a couple of times, and you get hailstones, and they come down. I don't see any rain taking place here. I don't hear any thunder. I don't see any lightning taking place. Where'd these stones come from? Not only that, these stones that if it was a regular thunderstorm and they just didn't happen to put the fact that there was a thunderstorm in here, these hailstones are coming down only on the enemy. They're not coming down on Israel. It's not a thunderstorm in the natural sense of things. It's a supernatural judgment of God. The first one, the children of Israel were able in their efforts to fight against the enemy. Here the children of Israel are doing absolutely nothing. I didn't get a chance to announce this morning, but got an email from Steve and Tammy the other day that the natural father of Katie's appeal for parental rights has been denied. The way now is open for them to go ahead and adopt Katie. Do you know what they did to secure that? Prayed and God delivered. There are going to be times when God is going to bring His justice upon those in a very supernatural way that you will just stand back and say, I had nothing to do with it. There it is. God did it Himself. He can and still does that. But then there's this. More people died from these hailstones than the children of Israel actually got by themselves, but that didn't get everything. And consequently, Joshua is recognizing that, you know, time's running out here. We're getting to the end of the day, and the night's going to come, and we won't be able to fight. And he said, if we're not be able to fight, then these people are going to be able to get away from us, and we won't really get all the victory that we really need to get. And he asked the Lord for help. And he crawls out to the sun and says, stand still. I need more daylight to fight and finish this battle. Interesting. Here's a group of people that traveled all night, 25 miles uphill very quickly, were exhausted after already a day's work. Now they go into battle. They've been fighting all day. Joshua says, we need more time to fight. God's really energizing, isn't He? I mean, really, miraculously energizing. But now they need something, not just energy to fight the battle. They need something outside of themselves, some type of supernatural enablement to finish things off. And the sun stood still. Bible critics, whether good or otherwise, have had a field day with the interpretation of what went on here. There are basically three ways of understanding this passage, and I'm going to give them to you kind of quickly. First is the total eclipse view. The view says that it wasn't really light that was promoted, it was darkness that God gave. And they do some linguistic studies and say that the one Hebrew word can really mean come to a secession or cease or lose its power, and that he wasn't saying for the sun to stand still, but for the sun to quit, because the children of Israel, they were getting worn out by this hot sun. By the way, it was hot sun beating down on them. It wasn't rain clouds. And they needed some refreshment from this, so he's asking that the sun be taken away, that it would be cooler temperatures, and therefore they could be able to finish the people off. Well, if it refreshed Israel, it would refresh the other armies too. If it was nighttime, it would aid the other armies in getting away. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. In fact, over in verse 14, it says, there was never a day like that afterwards. Well, there have been many days with solar eclipses. In fact, the most interesting one was the day Christ died. For a period of 3 hours, the sun didn't shine. I don't think that answers the problem. The second one is the poetic interpretation. That says that these words are not to be taken literally. And there is a little bit of reason for that. The words verse 13, where it's talking about, is this not written in the book of Jasher, which is an extra biblical writing, was written in a poetic form. But oftentimes poetic language is used to describe literal events. And there's no reason to say that we shouldn't take this literally. I think this is the way it's to be understood. In fact, that's the third thing. Somehow, the light was prolonged. The question is, how did God do that? I'll give you five different things here real quickly. Number one, it's been suggested that the rotation of the earth was supernaturally slowed down. We tell time because the earth is rotating on its axis, and consequently we're in view of the sun on an average of 12 hours a day. And as we rotate around, we get away from the sun, you can't see it. Well, if you stop when you're facing the sun, therefore it's going to seem like the day is going to last forever. And somehow God slowed down the earth's rotation or even stopped it. God is capable of doing that. Now man will say, well, wait a minute, that violates all natural law. Yep, it does. Isn't it good that God is supernatural? I mean, it was God who set up these laws. It's God who can suspend the laws for His purposes if He chooses to do so. So that's very possible. Secondly, one guy stated that the way God accomplished this is He sent a comet by the earth. The comet was huge. It had a great gravitational pull which slowed down the rotation of the earth. And not only that, the tail of the comet provided the hailstones that fell on the people. Sounds like a great natural explanation. Except for the fact that it's ridiculous. You see, if a comet came that close to the earth and had that much of a gravitational pull, we wouldn't be here. But it still doesn't explain how the rocks of the tail of the comet fell on only the enemies of God. That doesn't explain anything. Natural explanations can never be used to explain supernatural things. Thirdly, one fellow suggested that the earth was tilted on its axis. I have a friend from Bible college that was pastoring a church up in North Pole, Alaska. When he candidated for the position, they had him come up in December. Because they say too many, they found from experience that if people came up in June when there's 24 hours of light, that they say this is fantastic, and when they get that 24 hours of darkness, they say bye-bye. So they were bringing people up in the darkest parts of the year, and if they survived that, then they knew they'd stay around in the summer. And he said, well, what they did is, that God did, is he just tilted the earth this way so that Israel was now at the North Pole. Consequently, they had 24 hours of light. Well, certainly that would be able to explain it. The only problem is, if God went like this and tilted the earth, you know what would happen to the sun? One moment it's here, and the next moment it's over here. There's no record here that the sun moved. In fact, it says the sun stood still. That doesn't work. Here's probably the most ridiculous one. One fellow came up with the fact that there were at least five volcanoes, if not more, all pointed toward the east that had simultaneous eruptions of great magnitude. Now, understand that the earth is spinning. If these things are pointed to the east, it's going to be like retro rockets firing, and it's going to stop the rotation of the earth. Therefore, the sun's going to stand still. Well, the volcanoes would just stop erupting. But here's the problem. While they're erupting with all this lava, what becomes of the earth? I mean, we'd burn up. There wouldn't be any earth left. That's absolutely ridiculous. The fifth, and I believe the most probable, is that God supernaturally took the light from where it normally was and caused it to shine down upon Gibeon. Somehow God refracted, did whatever he had to do. The earth continued to revolve in its normal way, but God supernaturally directed that light down. A couple of reasons to believe that being the most probable. First of all, there are instances in Scripture where similar events take place, and they're found only on a local level. For example, in the days of Hezekiah, the sun went backwards 10 degrees. Well, up in Babylon, they heard about this, and they sent representatives down to Israel to find out what took place. If this was a worldwide phenomena, as halting the rotation of the earth would be, then there was no need for them to send representatives down. They would have experienced it where they were. This, with Hezekiah, was a local event. Seems to be that this one here could be a local event. On the contrary, remember Moses in Egypt. One of the 10 plagues was that there was darkness upon the children of Israel. But the children of Israel stayed in the light. Now, how can you have darkness in one point in Egypt and light in another? It was a localized thing. I think the most probable explanation is that God supernaturally just directed the light where it needed to go. May I say to you that there are going to be times when you have to suffer the consequences of a mistake, that God will supernaturally bring enablement from without that shouldn't normally be there, and it'll provide for victory. When we were in Bible college, we were living on a shoestring. I will never forget that I had an electric bill that was due, and I was just a few dollars short of being able to pay it. It was due on a Monday. Friends of mine visited over the weekend, and as they were leaving, they slipped me a $20 bill. I wasn't expecting that. But God provided. And God will always provide in a supernatural way, if necessary, the things that will enable you to do what is in the will of God. There's consequences to mistakes. It would have been great had Joshua said, "Hey, you Gibeonites, I don't think who you are, who you say you are." Not made the mistake, wiped them out. They would have never had to have these battles. By the way, these battles were slowing down the children of Israel from accomplishing the conquest of the land. There were consequences. But while it may have slowed them down, it didn't stop them. We will make mistakes, but God is greater than our mistakes, and His will always be accomplished. Let's pray. Father, we thank You tonight for how great You are. We praise You for the fact that when we fail, You still find ways that Your will can succeed and You can be glorified. Lord, it would be wonderful if we would never have to make a mistake again, but we recognize it'll happen. Encourage us tonight. While there may be consequences, victory is still to be found in the person of Jesus Christ. And may we go forward and be more than conquerors through Him who loved us. In His name we pray. Amen. By the way, one other thing from this morning. I was thinking about saying it, but once the service got started, and then because it was communion, and I think there was a